Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Lawmakers start working on a variety of bills, some of which will be much debated in the coming legislative session. Executive Counselor Andrew Valinsky makes his run for governor official, and the ACLU asks for a pause on a controversial new voting law. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we'll talk about them in this hour. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or email your questions about the week's news. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And we're also broadcasting a live video of this radio program today. When you find us on Facebook by searching for NHPR Exchange, you will find that video. You can also comment there as well. Here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, Kevin Landrigan, Union Leader Reporter, and Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Thank you all very much for being here today.
Good morning.
Hey, Peter.
So let's start with the news about Andrew Valinsky, the executive counselor from Concord. He has made his run for governor official. We've been hearing about a possible run for quite some time now. And here's a little bit from his launch video.
Believe it or not, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a football player. I didn't care that I was always the smallest kid on the field. I understand what it's like to be the underdog. That's why I fought for fair school funding in the 90s. It's why I've stayed involved, and it's why I ran for the executive council. Now I want to take that spirit to the governor's office.
So let's talk about Valinsky, what he stands for, and how his candidacy might take shape. Maybe start with you, Anna. What do you think of an Andrew Valinsky candidacy?
Sure. So Andrew Valinsky, we've definitely been seeing him kind of test the waters, think about running for a little while. And in particular, there have been some showdowns between the executive council and the governor, for example, over his nominee of Attorney General Gordon McDonald to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So somewhat like Dan Feltes, who is the current senator who's also running for governor on the Democratic side, Valinsky is progressive on a lot of these issues. But I think that one thing that sets him apart from Feltes is the fact that he has said he will not take against a pledge against an income or sales tax, and just because he's going to be open to whatever policy comes.
Yeah, and we have a little bit of sound from him explaining why he will not take that pledge.
If you take the pledge, you shut down honest conversation. We have some real problems in the state to address. We can't talk about any of those things if we take the pledge. So I'm refusing to take it.
So Valinsky says he's worried about shutting down conversation. Dean Spiliotis.
Well, there certainly is a conversation within the Democratic Party. This issue of whether or not to take the pledge is something that has infuriated progressives for a long time. They believe that being unwilling to have that conversation puts undue pressure on local property taxes, which are regressive. So this is something that Democrats have been debating within the primary for a long time, but it has thus far anyway proven to be a political loser in the general election. So he's going to have to figure out how he's going to navigate that. This is fascinating to me. You have two Concord lawyers who both, to some extent, draw from the same well of progressive support, even though they've each pressed Governor Sununu in their own way. As Anna was mentioning, Andrew Valinsky on the executive council with things like appointments and state contracts. Dan Feltes is a leader in the state Senate, and Feltes has already lined up a number of endorsements from Democratic state senators. So I'm fascinated to see how this is going to play out in terms of the progressive community that has supported both of these individuals in their respective roles of pushing back against Governor Sununu. They're now competing for the same nomination, and this issue of whether or not to take the pledge. It's been an important issue in Democratic primaries in the past, but as I said, it has thus far been a political loser in the general election. Maybe that'll change this time, but there's not a great track record for it.
Kevin Landry.
Well, Andrew Valinsky really made a name for himself in the Claremont lawsuit in the early 1990s. He was one of the lead lawyers that represented Claremont School District and others to sue the state, and got the Supreme Court to rule that over-reliance on local property taxes were unconstitutional. Another lawyer who was involved in that was John Tobin, who at the time was the executive director of New Hampshire Legal Assistance. For the past year, Valinsky and Tobin have been going around the state hosting forums trying to educate the public about the income inequality they say exists in the system and why we may need to change the tax structure if you want to dramatically increase education funding. But Valinsky has not been specific and won't be specific about whether he'll actually offer a plan to do that during this campaign. He said the campaign's more than a year long. Let's see how the response is, and we'll take it from there. As Dean pointed out, it's been a losing issue in the general election. It's been a losing issue since 2002 in the Democratic primary. Yeah. The pledge to veto an income to not veto an income tax. Mark Fernald was the last Democratic nominee who affirmatively said, "I support an income tax." We remember what happened in that 2002 election. Craig Benson not only became the only other governor other than Chris Sununu in the last 20 years.
Republican governor.
To be elected governor as a Republican. Thank you, Peter. Gene Shaheen lost the Senate seat to John E. Sununu, congressman at the time. Shaheen and Fernald were tagged as tax twins in that race. It was devastating to the Democratic ticket. It's one of the reasons why this race may not be fully formed yet. There are many establishment Democrats in the party who think Dan Feltis may be too liberal a nominee, and that's why many of them are encouraging Manchester Mayor Joyce Craig to not rule out a race for governor after this her re-election campaign is over next month.
We'll be talking about the Manchester mayoral race later in the program, Joyce Craig and challenger Victoria Sullivan. But I did want to ask you, Kevin and Anna, Dean, you can weigh in as well, on Andrew Valinsky's history with education funding. He did say, though he's not specific yet, about wanting schools to be adequately funded. Some may say that, okay, Andrew Valinsky, you fought with Claremont, the Claremont decisions 20 years ago. You've been going on tour with John Tobin, essentially drumming up support to get schools adequately funded. But it's been a two-decade effort. You've been trying to get this done, and it hasn't gotten done. Why should we as voters believe you now that you as governor can get schools adequately funded?
Yeah, I think that's a fair question. I think that will come up during this campaign. He's done a lot in those intervening 20 years. He was very involved in forming, Dean may recall, a super PAC that actually supported an income tax. And before the legislature, back in the late 1990s, when then-governor, Democratic governor Gene Shaheen was forced to threaten a veto an income tax, and then got Democrats in the state Senate to back off one.
Anna.
I think that realistically, the school funding issue in New Hampshire is going to have to be sort of buy-in from the public at large. You know, Valinsky, I don't think, executive counselor, as governor, it's not going to take one person, because really the question is about that willingness to create a pool of funding at the state level and not just rely on local funding in order to really bring up the amount that these towns are getting and equalize across property tax values, if you think that's appropriate. So I think that realistically the fact that he is still moving the debate forward in New Hampshire, which is very much resistance to sort of a state-down approach to education, speaks to his ability to stay relevant.
So give him credit for that, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and in theory, you could say, as Kevin mentioned, and I remember it well, also going back to the 2002 race. So it's been 18 years almost since that issue has really been vetted in a general election. You know, one possibility would be if Valinsky were to win and you keep a Democratic state legislature. And, you know, this kind of the political complexion of New Hampshire has changed a bit over the last 20 years. Maybe there would be some space for movement. But, you know, I remember talking about this with John Lynch. This has just been a very difficult issue for the state to figure out.
I also think it's worth noting that, so, you know, if Dan Feltis takes the pledge, I think that there will be pushback, however, because he did support the Democratic paid family and medical leave plan, which critics argued was a form of an income tax. And that could be debated because it was a payroll tax. You know, is it similar to more unemployment insurance, et cetera? But I think that the idea is, you know, that's not just a pure, clear-cut line anymore.
Mm-hmm. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. In just a moment, we'll be talking about the right to repair. The bill was just recommended to be sent to interim study committee. This bill would have forced some manufacturers of electronics to release manuals and other things that would help consumers like you and me repair things we buy, like our smartphones. Would you have made use of such a manual if a company were forced to produce it? Share us your thoughts on Right to Repair by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Another big political movement this week that's worth mentioning. Governor Sununu announced his support for a paid family leave plan. He had opposed the one, Anna, that you were just describing, put forward by Democrats. He said it created an income tax. That one didn't get anywhere. Anna, how would you describe the one that Sununu and some state Republicans now support?
Yes. So originally, going back to his original concept, it was that state employees in New Hampshire and Vermont would be enrolled in a paid family medical leave program, and that could create a pool with enough people involved that it would keep costs down for other employers and employees who wanted to opt in. Now, Vermont is off the table. The governor in Vermont, Phil Scott, was not able to get support from his state to make that happen. So Sununu has come back and he said, all right, we're just going to do this in New Hampshire. Once again, it starts with that base of state employees. But there are some important differences from the last time. For example, it's not going to be able to cover personal medical problems or injuries. It will only be for births, adoptions, and then if a family member has a medical injury. And he says, Sununu says, that 75% of the costs associated with paid family and medical leave are about that disability portion of the coverage, and that short-term disability can cover it. So people dispute, you know, does that sort of hollow out the coverage? But he's arguing that's one way to keep costs down. The other important difference is that there is a credit against the business enterprise tax for employers who choose to opt into this coverage.
Yeah. It's amazing to me to think. I remember back in the 2016 campaign when John Sununu was Chris Sununu was running for governor the first time. When you'd ask him what's an area where you might work well with Democrats, it was always this Family Medical Leave Act was something that they started talking about. And there's just this fundamental difference over, you know, whether you make it a mandatory program like the Democrats want, or you have this potential for a payroll tax, and the Republicans seized on that as a form of an income tax, or as is the case with this particular proposal, which is being supported by Jeb Bradley in the state Senate. Provide incentives. Anna mentioned the business enterprise tax. Provide these credits in order to make it more appealing for these products to exist in a private insurance market, and that. The fundamental debate, again, is always cost. And as you said, with the original proposal with Vermont, they couldn't get anybody to jump into the pool, which was the issue of keeping costs down. With this, you know, the issue will be whether or not this argument about the disability really is what is driving up cost. And if you take that out of the equation, will that in some way make this more affordable and more attractive on the private insurance market?
Kevin Lanigan.
One thing Sununu looked at with this new proposal, too, is what about individuals who work for a company that don't join this paid family leave program? Shouldn't we allow those individuals to be empowered to opt in and buy that benefit for themselves? So he does that in this bill, but Insurance Commissioner John Elias advised him, you've got to find a way. They're just individuals floating out there, not working for a company, meaning the insurance companies need to manage risk. So how do you do that? Well, one way you do that is you actually subsidize the premiums they would pay so they're not too high. He does that in two ways. One, he would cap the premiums these individuals would pay at $5 per week. And he does that essentially by tapping into the existing insurance premium tax, which would take revenues from that tax that all insurance companies pay and create a rate stabilization fund, which would be used to subsidize those insurance premiums that individuals would purchase.
Mm-hmm. And the big part about this whole debate about paid family, and once was once medical, but now there's no medical in this, is that it couldn't be mandatory. It had to be optional. So what you were describing, Kevin, is a way for people to opt in, yes?
Yes, right.
Anna.
And I think that really what's difficult about Sununu's plan is it's really new. It's really untested. When you look at what other states have done on this issue, it has been statewide. Everybody gets involved. And so is it enough of a pool with state employees? Are you only going to have people opt in who are going to use it immediately, and it's going to be a real drain on the program? So I think it's hard when you looked at the opt-in, opt-out question of, is this financially viable? And there's a lot of studies. You know, he's had a whole year now to be looking at this, but I think there's still big question marks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the other thing this plan does, and Anna's right, when you don't have a mandatory program, you have a smaller pool. And insurance companies are afraid of small pools because they can be fraught with higher risks than normally exist in the market. So another thing Sununu does in this proposal is actually allow insurers to charge different rates for this insurance based on experience or rating factors, which means jobs that are more likely to make greater use of these leave policies could pay more for the coverage. What kind of jobs? Well, which gender is more likely to take family leave? That would be women. So particularly jobs such as in education, childcare, healthcare, those rates could be different than in, say, a white-collar banking employer who had this leave.
So you're saying in a subtle way, it opens it up to criticism that it could be discriminatory.
Well, it's certainly the rate's not going to be universal, and depending on the kind of job you have and the use of that leave, you may pay more. But back to Anna's point, this was Sununu at Insurance Commissioner Elias's insistence, trying to make this a plan that insurance companies would actually write. And would actually participate.
Yeah, part of the problem is that they don't find it particularly cost-effective to offer these plans. So you're incentivizing the insurance markets to make this more attractive for them, and that's one of the criticisms of Democrats. And the reception among Democrats for this has not been great. I think this is going to get rolled into the next gubernatorial election campaign. Basically, the argument is that the Democrats argue that this is, you know, really subsidies and a moneymaker for the insurance industry, not something that assures employees that they will have this opportunity if they want it.
Let's talk about the politics of this. Why does Sununu keep talking about family and paid leave? The reason is polling. Polling shows that family medical leave is an 80% issue, meaning 80% of the people out there like the idea of having the option of paid family medical leave. But it's a soft 80%, meaning it is not the top issue on the minds of voters. So if you're Sununu and you're running for re-election for a third term against a Democrat who supports a mandatory paid leave plan, you keep pushing an alternative, your alternative. Because even if it doesn't go anywhere in the campaign, you get to say, I talked about family leave. I wanted to offer family leave. The Democratic legislature rejected it out of hand. That he thinks that'll be enough for voters to give him some credit.
And he ran on this in 2018. Yeah. Molly Kelly, the Democratic gubernatorial nominee, this was the centerpiece of her campaign, and he still managed to win with the ideas that he was putting forward, even if we're now 4 years, almost 4 years out from him being elected, and we still don't have something in place.
This is the Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Also this week, the House Commerce and Consumer Affairs Committee agreed to recommend to send to interim study committee a bill that would have forced manufacturers of some electronics, like Apple, to share tools and manuals to allow people to repair them themselves. And this was called the so-called right to repair legislation. Anna, why do people need a piece of legislation to have the so-called right to repair?
So you have companies like Apple and Samsung, and they have these smartphones in particular, but other technology, and they argue that this is proprietary technology, that it can be difficult and dangerous to repair, and so it should only be repaired at certified locations. Well, that can be incredibly expensive for people, and especially if it comes to just changing out a battery. Consumer advocates argue you should be able to do that without paying hundreds of dollars to a certified repair shop. But that means these companies have to release their manuals. So right to repair basically means that these companies would have to release information about how to repair these products on your own. Of course, companies are very against this because there's the question of, you know, just letting their technology out there into the public so anybody can figure out all their wonderful secrets. But also there are safety concerns, especially when it comes to other healthcare or agricultural technology.
Mm-hmm. We get an email on this subject from Michael who said, I repair rather than replace because it's almost always outrageously cheaper. I recently repaired a Jeep engine management computer, which has no longer been available from Jeep as a new part. The used part from a junkyard, which could have had the same problems, was around $500. I fixed the problem, a bad resistor, for less than $5. Less junk in landfills and potential savings for consumers why not do it? So, well, yeah, why not do it, Dean?
Well, I think Massachusetts has this in place for automobiles.
Yes.
Cars are kind of where you typically think this would be an kind of a no-brainer. People want to work on an old Jeep or something else. But, you know, is this idea of, you know, see your authorized dealer when you need a repair. And and so my understanding was the original proposal was pretty broad, and then those issues of, you know, mechanical safety, agricultural safety, things like that, weighed in, and then they narrowed it, I think, just to consumer electronics.
Right. Which is still a big deal, right?
Absolutely. But I can't imagine Apple's going to say, okay, New Hampshire, here you go. Here's all our, you know, here are all our trade secrets.
You're saying that...
I imagine there would be a legal pushback against something like this, proprietary technology.
I believe New Hampshire would be the first state in the nation to do this with consumer electronics.
Yeah, it would be an interesting test case, but can't imagine these big companies giving up their manuals and their trade secrets that way.
Just because New Hampshire says, hey, I have to do it.
For people to be able to replace their own battery.
So it might be if proponents want to fight for a right to repair law, maybe best as a federal law, Kevin?
Yeah, maybe. I do think the public interest research group chapters around the country are pushing this idea. And the reason is because consumers like to fix their stuff, as Michael just pointed out. It's very true that they do. And also, Apple has some tough history on this. I mean, in 2017, it came out that Apple was deliberately slowing down its phones so that the batteries wouldn't crash the system. And the outrage was so great, they agreed to replace batteries for $29 instead of the usual $79. And that's what drives people crazy is, why should I throw out a $1,000 smartphone when all I need is a $40 battery?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's some incentive for legislators to protect consumers in this way, but how can they do it in a way that won't get them sued by Apple or Samsung? Right. All right. Well, this is a story that we may pick up again because who knows? I mean, there's a recommendation to send it to interim study, but the whole House may feel otherwise. So we'll pay attention to this as it proceeds. But speaking of legislation, there are legislative service requests now at the State House. The session is going to come up in January. The Caledonian Record reports that a Democratic representative from Concord, Catherine Rogers, is proposing legislation that would ban all assault weapons in New Hampshire, require a background check for commercial gun sales, and impose a waiting period between the purchase of a firearm and its delivery. Kevin Landrigan,
yes.
Your thoughts on the legs such a bill would have?
Well, as we've seen this past session, we had Governor Chris Sununu veto three gun control bills, one a background check, one a school zone bill, one a waiting period. But Representative Rogers is creative. And assault weapons ban wasn't on tap. And you can rework a number of these bills to try and reintroduce them. I think some of them, much as they did this past spring, will have legs in the legislature. And I think all of them, much like they did this year, will be vetoed by Governor Chris Sununu if they get that far.
Anna Brown.
I think that this is definitely a case of Democratic legislators trying to make Sununu's platform clear before we hit the election in 2020. Because, yes, Sununu has made clear he will veto these issues. But for many Democrats, they are a top priority. And so you're also seeing LSRs, which, once again, legislative service requests. It's basically a bill request relative to voluntary surrender of firearms. That's something you're also seeing in presidential debates, requiring a locking safety device on firearms, et cetera. But I think it's also interesting for people to understand that what an LSR is, legislative service request, basically legislators request bills for 2020 months before 2020 starts. And it's the Office of Legislative Services that works on drafting these bills. So it's actually a good time to contact your legislator if there's an issue you're concerned about or a bill request you see and you think, oh, what's that about?
They can put in a request for you. And who knows, the thing you were concerned about might be a bill in the legislature in January.
Absolutely.
Democracy at work. Sounds great.
Yeah, these LSRs are a lot of fun to look through. I think we're already up over 600 as of mid-October. You know, all members of the state legislature can request help in drafting bills from the Office of Legislative Services. I believe they all will get at least some sort of minimal vote at some point in the state legislature. And, you know, it really is there's really something for everyone. Some of the bills are always pop up session after session. It's a way to kind of get a general sense of where the two parties are and how they prioritize their respective issues. I think on the gun control stuff, it's going to be completely driven by whether or not we have a Republican or Democratic governor and a Republican or Democratic state legislature. That's really driven driven by the larger partisan politics. And we just saw that with the bills that Governor Sununu vetoed. My favorite one, if I recall correctly, was there was something about repealing the ban on hunting with ferrets. And I didn't know you could actually hunt with ferrets, but apparently you can, and you're not allowed to in New Hampshire, and somebody wants to repeal that.
Yeah, so that's actually Rep. Max Abramson, and it's part of a concern that he has about that there are ridiculous laws on the books in New Hampshire, such as the prohibition last year on putting anything other than milk in a milk container. And so he's good at pulling some of those out that make you wonder about what exactly is happening in New Hampshire's legal history.
I hope that NHPR's Sean Hurley will do a story on hunting with ferrets. That is a sound-rich piece I want to hear some Friday afternoon. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We've got lots more to discuss today, including how the ACLU of New Hampshire is asking a federal judge to put HB 1264 on hold. You may recall that's a bill that tries to make anyone who votes here in New Hampshire a resident of New Hampshire, requires them to register motor vehicles and whatnot after the fact. But there is some confusion about the bill, and that's what's prompting the request to put this on hold. We're going to talk about that after a short break and after we round up a few other stories from the week's news. If you've got questions or comments, email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
On Monday, on The Exchange, we'll be talking with 2020 Democratic presidential candidate Tom Steyer as part of our forums in collaboration with New Hampshire PBS. If you have questions to ask Steyer, you can submit it at our website, nhpr.org. Right now, we're taking a fresh look at the events of the past week on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. In the studio with me, Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, Kevin Landrigan, Union Leader State House Reporter, and Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. I want to start this part of the program by talking with you, Kevin, about a couple of things that you wrote about. Sure. One of them in the UL this week was that a House committee recommended killing a bill that would allow drivers to get into their car if they've had too much to drink, so long as they don't get into the driver's seat. They could get into the passenger seat, they can get in the back seat, and as it was described, sleep it off. So some say that would make the roads safer, keep people from driving drunk, but what's the story of this bill? How did the discussion go?
Yeah, really interesting discussion. I think most people would be surprised to know that you can be in your car with the motor running and not driving it and still be charged with driving drunk. If, for example, an officer were to tail you into a parking lot and then you fall asleep in the car and it's running, he could charge you with driving drunk. This legislation, which passed the Senate unanimously last spring and was retained by the House, was somewhat complicated. The House committee tried to make it simple, as you just described it, which is to the driver. If you're not behind the wheel and the car is not running, you can't be charged with driving drunk. Now, some courts in some states have actually thrown out and ruled illegal these prosecutions, and that provided some of the impetus for this legislation. But the Police Chiefs Association, the local police chiefs, the state troopers, they all oppose this bill. They all want to give the cops the right to make these judgment calls. And sometimes they maintain that, as I was saying earlier, the driver essentially pretends to be asleep or drives quickly into the parking lot when they know they're being tailed by a cop and try and use that for them. This committee voted 9-8 against this legislation. As Anna pointed out, that's just a recommendation. Goes to the full House now. The House historically has not looked favorably on this bill, but it's gotten more legs than it ever has before.
So that's the bill regarding sleeping it off. Pretty narrow vote. Yes. We can return to that. That'd be an interesting story to see how that goes.
Sure would.
Another story you wrote about in the Union Leader this week, Kevin, was that Elizabeth Warren's plan to provide more federal assistance to the nation's public schools would kind of leave New Hampshire out in at least one facet of the plan. It has to do with the way New Hampshire structures things and how Elizabeth Warren has sort of independently planned her finance plan. How does it not jive?
Well, it's her education plan, which is very ambitious, very comprehensive, But the cornerstone of it would quadruple what's spent on Title I spending, which is for low-income students. And the way it leaves out New Hampshire is her plan would only provide that increase to states that either increase funding for schools or have what are called more progressive funding formulas. That's that leaves New Hampshire out, right? I mean, as a state with the most that is the most reliant on property taxes in the country, we don't have a progressive funding formula. In these, she cited a study by the Education Law Center, the Graduate School of Education at Rutgers, that praised 11 states for these for making these changes, including Massachusetts, to change their formulas to divert more money into high poverty school districts. New Hampshire was ranked near the bottom of that rating. She also would eliminate the federal grant program to expand charter schools. As we saw a couple of months ago, New Hampshire got a record five-year, $46 million grant to expand charter schools in our state. So there are some parts of her plan that would help us, to be clear. Upgrades to infrastructure. We, as you know, we've had a moratorium on state school building aid for almost a decade now. She also would, for the first time, meet the long-argued mandate of federal government supporting 40% of costs for special education. Right now it supports about 15% of the cost. So New Hampshire would benefit there.
Anna Brown.
I think it's worth noting that New Hampshire is currently going to be convening a commission to study the issue of how we fund our schools. And there's that lawsuit going on. So right now she doesn't like how we fund our schools, but New Hampshire is going to have to find a path forward here. And I think there are going to need to be some changes no matter how long we dig in our heels. The lawsuits keep on coming. So
and maybe the lawsuit you're referring to, that's the school district suing the state because they believe they're not being adequately funded.
Yes, yes. So there was a Conval school district, and there was a lower court ruling that ruled in favor of the school district. It's going to make its way, obviously, up to the Supreme Court eventually. And there are some other legal maneuverings going on there. We don't need to get into the weeds. But basically, New Hampshire is in trouble with its school funding, as it has been for a long time.
We need to point out this is the fifth commission or study committee about education funding, and all of them have not produced a new funding formula. We also need to point out that Claremont lawsuit we talked about in 1997, where the Supreme Court ruled the over-reliance on local property taxes was unconstitutional. What was the legislature's response? The creation of a $400 million statewide property tax. They also increased some funding, diverted some money from tobacco taxes and other taxes to local schools. But there was no fundamental progressive funding formula that came out of that either.
Yeah, you know, this proposal would certainly require some significant changes on how education is funded here in New Hampshire. And as Anna said, we may be moving in that direction, but we've seen how difficult this has been over the last almost 20 years. And, you know, the bigger picture here is education has been a key issue among the Democratic presidential primary candidates. Bernie Sanders just announced that he would forgive all student debt, and a number of candidates have proposed a free public university, et cetera, and other ways in which education may be better funded. Certainly, public education better funded. You know, these kinds of proposals, the conservative argument here in New Hampshire will be that this is, you know, another way for the federal government to control how New Hampshire educates its own students, and that you get locked in. You remember going all the way back to George W. Bush and No Child Left Behind and trying to dictate standards in exchange for more federal dollars. So that's going to kind of be the conservative approach here. But, you know, a lot of the candidates in the Democratic primary are going big, and this is another example of it. But the idea of New Hampshire coming up with some sort of as Liz Warren would think of a progressive funding formula, we're a ways away from that right now.
Mm-hmm. Also in the news this week, municipal aid payments from the state have started to make their way to cities and towns throughout the state. And in New Hampshire, in Portsmouth, the aid is making up for a loss in funding from the Keno law passed a few years ago. That money was supposed to go to a fund for kindergarten. Now it's in school building aid. Anna, so what exactly was the difference in reality versus expectation when it came to Portsmouth?
Sure. So they were expecting, I think it was about roughly $180,000 for quote-unquote kindergarten, which was basically money raised through Keno across the strait, was dedicated to funding for kindergarten students. And the state folded instead. Kindergarten students are now just part of all of the funding for schools, so they get the same per-pupil funding system as goes for students in grades 1 through 12. Well, that ended up shortchanging Portsmouth just because of how their students are factored into the formula. So they're losing out on that $180,000 roughly, but they're getting, I think it was about $200,000 in municipal aid. And so this was something that passed in the most recent budget. New Hampshire used to share a lot more state revenue with towns across New Hampshire, and this budget put some of that more back into place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the issue here was that as Keno was originally sold to different towns and cities, it was supposed to, I think they had anticipated something like $11 million in revenue over the first couple of years, and it only cut about $2 million. And so they had to rethink the whole idea of linking kindergarten funding to Keno revenue, and Portsmouth doesn't actually, is not one of the cities that has Keno, but you would still share in those revenues. So this is part and parcel of the shift from, as Anna was saying, tied to just Keno revenue to part of the larger budget now to make sure that minimum guarantee is met.
And it seems like the cities and towns would have more flexibility with the municipal aid than it would from the Keno funding, yes?
Yes.
The municipal aid is I hesitate to say blank check because that's pretty broad statement. But they have a broad flexibility. Yeah. It doesn't just have to go to schools. It doesn't just have to go to infrastructure. They can move it around in their budgets where they see the need.
Also in the news this week, stories that NHPR has been following. A woman detained in the Stratford County Jail is suing, arguing the detention violated her civil rights. Robin White of Avon, Maine, alleges she was arrested for having a small amount of heroin in her purse. And then over 2 weeks, she allegedly was subject to multiple full body scans, as well as a cavity search performed at Wentworth Douglas Hospital. Nothing else was found. She's now suing several officers and the hospital, which she alleges sent her a bill for the cavity search. Also, the University of New Hampshire and Eversource, the state's largest utility, are working together to reduce the university's environmental impact at its Durham campus. The partnership includes nearly 20 energy efficiency projects and supports the university's Climate Action Plan, which aims to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And federal researchers are now recruiting Portsmouth area residents for its first of its kind health study on PFAS chemical exposure. They gave an overview to at least 150 residents at a meeting last night. The Centers for Disease Control will look at PFAS levels and potentially related health problems in more than 1,300 adults and children who drank contaminated water at Pease International Tradeport. Also in the news this week that we should talk about, the ACLU of New Hampshire is asking a federal judge to put HB 1264 on hold. Now, this bill would have made voting in New Hampshire a declaration of residency, which would then force people to register their cars here. People like college students, for example, who may not have originally had any intention of registering their cars here in New Hampshire. Democrats have opposed HB 1264. Republicans have pushed for it. Now the ACLU wants to hold it off. Anna Brown, why?
Okay, so there's a lot of confusion about how exactly this law is going to be enforced, what penalties people might really face. Because here's the thing. If you vote, that doesn't necessarily go to the DMV. So how is the state going to be following up to see is your car registered in New Hampshire? Because you don't have to produce a car registration to vote.
Right.
There's a lot of other documentation that you can use. So is the state going to be hunting these people down? Is the DMV going to have a new job? What do people really need to be worried about? What are the enforcement mechanisms here? So there is a fair amount of confusion. And the argument by the state is basically that, well, the law says that if you vote, you're declaring residency and you need to do this, and that's it. It's the law. Follow the law. The details of how it's enforced are not essential to what the law states.
Is there a deadline between, okay, I vote on primary day, I have 30 days to register my car?
So it's basically like you're declaring residency.
So you have to do it almost instantly.
Well, no, there's always that time period.
Yeah.
And I apologize, I can't remember if it's 30 days or 60 days. I believe it's 30 days. But there's a window, because the idea is you can't, as soon as you move to New Hampshire, for example, you wouldn't instantly walk right into the DMV. So there's that little window, but it's pretty immediate. The idea is, all right, you've done this, bam, you're resident.
Yeah, there's just a lot of confusion here. You know, the town clerks are wondering, you know, how is this going to be enforced? The DMV hasn't necessarily said that they have a plan for how they would do these kinds of checks to see whether or not people have registered cars or have driver's licenses. This is particularly interesting because essentially what's happened is the ACLU has asked the federal courts to take a pause so that it can then get a special certification from the New Hampshire Supreme Court about how this might be enforced. And, you know, the federal argument is a constitutional argument about the right to vote. So, you know, the Constitution was amended to drop the voting age down to 18. A lot of 18-year-olds go to college. If they now have to deal with what essentially the ACLU argues are poll taxes, paying for car registration, licenses, et cetera, is that infringing on their constitutional right to vote? So you got the federal constitutional debate going on, and the ACLU is now saying, let's just put this on hold. Let's go to the state Supreme Court, get clarification about these enforcement issues, and then proceed with the lawsuit at the federal level. So it's essentially asking for a delay in this going into effect.
And what a shock, presidential politics and knee-deep in this debate,
yeah.
Right? We had an affidavit this week from Elizabeth Warren's state campaign director, Elizabeth Wester, who happened before she worked for Elizabeth Warren's campaign, was state director of America Votes, which is very much involved in organizing, recruiting on college campuses people to vote. And the affidavit from the Warren campaign was interesting because it sort of revealed trade secrets. You rarely see a campaign submit a document in court that says, here's what we're advising students in terms of voting or not voting, registering or not registering. And the affidavit essentially says we're providing a lot less information to students because we really don't know what to tell them. America Votes submitted their own affidavit. So did the Hanover town clerk submitted an affidavit, said 24 students have come in and talked to me. And I'm getting conflicting advice from the Secretary of State's office and other state agencies, so I'm not sure what to tell them. So the presidential politics argument is this. One of the temporary reliefs the ACLU in New Hampshire is asking for is to delay enforcement of this law until at least after the first in the nation primary so that this law would not apply to people who sign up and register to vote on election day of the first in the nation primary.
Stories about HB 1264 and SB 3, the other voting law that has really captured a lot of attention here in New Hampshire, have been... they've taken up so much oxygen. And another story that's taken up a lot of oxygen has been the idea of voter fraud. And we had a story of someone who has voted twice in the 2018 election this past week, worth mentioning, a guy named Robert Bell, 77-year-old registered Republican, had been found guilty in voting both in New Hampshire and Florida in last November's elections. He admits to voting twice, but he says he was confused about it. So, Anna Brown, what do you make of this case?
Sure. So... the way that this happened is he did early voting in Florida, which is when polls are open earlier. He used to live there, and then he did, you know, then came up to New Hampshire, and during the regular election time, he voted in New Hampshire. So it carries a maximum of 3.5 to 7 years in prison and up to a $4,000 fine, although his sentencing has yet to take place. We know he's guilty, but how much is he really going to be punished for this? I don't think he was confused about the fact that he voted twice. That seemed to be very obvious, but it was perhaps... giving him the benefit of the doubt, confusion about that it was wrong to vote in two states. Because, of course, there are different people on the ballots in the two states. The president would be the same, but if you're looking at who's in Congress, who's in the state offices, that would be different. I think it's worth noting that this is not the first case that New Hampshire has come up with. Mm-hmm. There have been a few others recently, mm-hmm. and often the case there has been that someone votes by absentee ballot in one town, for example, in Massachusetts, and then also votes in the general election in New Hampshire.
And I'm not sure if that's what the case is here, but if it is, it wouldn't be the first time someone has felt entitled to vote in two places because they live in two places. But the truth is, you have to pick a place.
Yes.
Yes. Dean?
Yeah, you know, this the larger context here goes back to the 2016 election. We recall Hillary Clinton beat Donald Trump in the popular vote by almost 3 million votes. And President Trump set up that commission on voter integrity because he claimed that there was a, you know, large scale or wholesale voter fraud, people being bussed into New Hampshire. He ended up losing New Hampshire in the general election to Hillary Clinton by a small margin. The last time he was here a month or two ago, he yet again brought up the idea that he actually believes he won New Hampshire if you take out all of the voter fraud that he believes occurred. So, you know, there's been this debate for years now over the scale of voter fraud. You always find these individual cases. But as Anna said, that's what they are. They're individual cases. There's zero evidence of any widespread voter fraud. And I was very critical of that voter integrity commission when President Trump set it up. It ended up collapsing under its own weight, which was not a surprise to me. And, you know, this is just a continuation driven by Project Veritas, which is this conservative group that videotapes people engaging in acts of fraud they believe are occurring. So, you know, we're going to continue to find these individual cases. But the larger debate over wholesale fraud, which I'm sure we're going to hear about again in 2020, there just is no evidence of that.
Well, I think it's also worth noting that New Hampshire is in some ways protected from that because we are still relying on a paper ballot system. And some people argue that that makes New Hampshire very backwards. Other people say it's old school and it works well, and it does make us less susceptible to,
Bill
to fraud or
big
hacking.
On that. He wants the Secretary of State, he wants paper ballot. But we still have the same claim. We still have the claims regardless,
yes.
Even though in practice, you're right, it's harder to do with a paper ballot.
Lots more to watch when it comes to voter fraud in general, HB 1264 in particular. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll do a little preview of the Manchester mayoral race between incumbent Democrat Joyce Craig and Republican challenger Victoria Sullivan. We'll also talk about a few other stories in the news this week, so stay with us. And if you've got questions about the week's news, send them in by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, and we will be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, Union Leader State House Reporter Kevin Landrigan, and Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Send us a note if you've got questions or comments. We might be able to incorporate them into the show. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And let's talk about the Manchester mayoral race, because voters in Manchester are going to be choosing their mayor in the coming election. Incumbent Democrat Joyce Craig and Republican challenger and former state rep Victoria Sullivan, they're in the race. They'll actually be debating at NHPR next week, Monday at 2 o'clock, in partnership with the New Hampshire Union Leader, so you can tune in for that. Craig and Sullivan debated this past week as well. Kevin Landrigan, are there a few big issues that New Manchester voters are really going to be listening carefully to these candidates about as the election approaches?
Yeah, well, I think certainly the opioid crisis is a big issue in this race. Joyce Craig says she's done a whole lot to deal with it, expanding safe stations, the millions of dollars in grant money that's flowed through the city and provided expanding the hub-and-spoke system that exists there. Former State Representative Victoria Sullivan essentially says Craig has not done enough. And we may recall some weeks ago there was a bit of a dust-up between Governor Chris Sununu, Republican, and Manchester Mayor Joyce Craig, the Democrat, about who was doing more to deal with the opioid crisis. So I think certainly that's a big issue there. We have a tax cap in Manchester that exists in order to keep property taxes low. That tax cap has been overridden in the past. Victoria Sullivan is very much against that, fiscal conservative. As I said, former Republican legislator, former assistant majority leader in the House, someone who the Republicans are pretty optimistic about that she can wage a strong challenge to this popular mayor, Joyce Craig.
Dean Spiliotis.
Yeah, there is this debate about the recent spike in homelessness and what the cause is, and you know, some people say that Manchester is in a way a victim of its own success. The Safe Stations program has been successful. There's all this additional money. The hub and spoke system has essentially turned Manchester into kind of a magnet for people from other places who are seeking help or treatment. And so Craig's argument has been that this issue of homelessness and where it intersects with opioid use is really a state issue, and that she's going to continue to work with the state to increase resources. And obviously Victoria Sullivan is claiming that it's a function of the mayor not doing enough. And then there's this other debate about whether Manchester is more safe or less safe now in terms of crime. There's some debate over the statistics. Mayor Craig, I think, is providing for hiring some additional, maybe 15 police officers or something like that. Yes. But there is a sort of debate over the data about whether or not Manchester is actually more safe now or less safe. And that's kind of gotten mixed in with all the other issues about homelessness. We've talked about the bail reform issue and people going in and out of police custody. And so there's a complex set of issues here and Manchester is kind of where they're all playing out.
I think it's interesting to note that when Victoria Sullivan was serving in the State House of Representatives, her bailiwick was more education-related issues, and she does have a background with the PTA. So, for example, she sponsored a bill that required play-based learning and unstructured time in kindergarten. She sponsored another bill that required advance notice to parents for human sexual education topics. So it's interesting to me that that was her bailiwick, but you're not really seeing that come up in her platform since, of course, there is a lot of debate about Manchester schools and curriculum that goes on. They had kind of came up with their own standards related to Common Core. So it's interesting that she is really more focused on the law enforcement and substance use disorder treatment angle of things when that was not really her bailiwick.
Well, and then you're right, that those standards issues, those were big debates in Manchester for a number of the mayoral races.
Well, again, the debate between Manchester Mayor Joyce Craig, incumbent, and challenger Representative Victoria Sullivan coming up Monday at 2 on NHPR. That's held in partnership with the New Hampshire Union Leader. Other stories that NHPR has been following this week, federal officials will soon launch a task force on offshore wind development in the Gulf of Maine with officials from New Hampshire, Maine, and Massachusetts. At a business meeting in Manchester yesterday, developers like Ken Bowes with Eversource said New Hampshire could take a leading role in that regional effort. He and others urged New Hampshire officials to consider creating a wind energy procurement program similar to those passed by southern New England states. Also, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren's presidential campaign says its headquarters in Manchester has been broken into, along with other offices in the same building. The campaign says in a statement that the break-in occurred on Wednesday night, and quote, "We have no reason to believe this was targeted to the campaign or is anything further than a regular break-in." And New Hampshire's highest court is operating without a Chief Justice. The Executive Council voted along party lines to reject Governor Chris Sununu's nomination of Attorney General Gordon McDonald to lead the court back in July. That vote angered Sununu, who decried it as political, and he said he's taking what he termed a pause before making another nomination. 3 months later, Sununu says his pause remains in effect with no end in sight. Also in the news this week, the union leader reported that the Hampstead School Board voted unanimously this week to adopt a policy that prohibits any visitor from bringing a gun into Hampstead school buildings. Kevin Landrigan, that excludes on-duty law enforcement. What do you make of this new policy?
It's interesting. I think it does come as we talked about early in the program. Comes a month after Governor Sununu vetoed legislation and the legislature upheld that veto to establish gun-free school zones in school. Now, this policy would apply to school employees, visitors, and all other people, with the exception of an off-duty police officer, at Hampstead Central School and also at the middle school. Students can't bring guns into school. Let's make that clear. The New Hampshire Safe Schools Act covers that. But New Hampshire is one of only three states, along with Wyoming and Hawaii, that don't have laws that prohibit firearms on school property. It's something that certainly the gun owners in this state take great pride in, that they feel, as we saw with reports in the last week, New Hampshire's in the top 10 per capita in gun ownership in the country. It's also in the top 10 in the country in the safest states in the country when it comes to violent crime, and number one when it comes to murder by use of a firearm, which probably surprises people here because homicides are up and many of those homicides have been with guns. But in the aggregate, we remain the lowest state in the country for the use of a gun committing murder.
Anna Brown.
So this is a really interesting legal landscape because there actually is a federal law that prohibits anyone from bringing a firearm onto school grounds unless they have a permit, which in New Hampshire would be someone voluntarily chooses to get a concealed carry permit, since you don't need a permit in New Hampshire to carry concealed carry. But for the federal law, you do need a permit. But then local police aren't going to enforce the federal law. So you're in this weird place where local school districts are like, well, it's banned, but there's nothing we can do about it. So we want to come up with our own policies. Right. But also state law really restricts what school districts and towns can pass in terms of laws. And technically, it doesn't seem that they actually have the legal authority to pass a ban like this at the local level. And that's why you saw bills at the state level last year kind of flew under the radar a little bit, because there was the bill for the statewide ban. There was another bill that did not succeed that would have just given school districts the choice to ban or not ban. That bill didn't go anywhere. Now you have Hampstead just saying, we're going to do it anyway. So there might be a lawsuit on the horizon. On the other hand, there are many examples where towns in New Hampshire have passed laws and regulations all on their own, and no one has challenged it.
All right. Well, final story to discuss this week. We haven't done an animal story in a while, so now now it is time. Chickens are becoming more popular as pets and producers of food and eaters of ticks in people's backyards in cities. And the Concord Monitor reported this week on Francesca Brown, a four-year-old who lives not too far from City Hall in Concord, who has hens who were her pets. But they were in violation of the city's ordinance, which says that chickens should be kept 30 feet from the neighbor's property. These chickens were 19 feet. The neighbors were upset. The city council was thinking of changing that to 5 feet. That didn't quite work out. Dean, chickens in the cities.
I live in Concord. I run into city officials on Main Street all the time, and I ask them, what are the hot issues in the city? And they all say, chickens. We're talking about chickens. this so-called kind of urban agriculture has become increasingly popular. I have had friends who have raised chickens and then gotten rid of them, others who are still raising them. If they free range, they can be somewhat messy. They peck at the ground a lot. That's one of the benefits, right? Some people think it's a good thing. Others, not so much. So this is one of those areas where cities have to kind of figure out how to deal with this. And so there is this debate over what is an appropriate placement for a coop, and how many chickens can you have, and what kinds of space do you need. And the big issue is for properties under 1 acre. That's where the problem really is.
Anna Brown?
Yeah, I mean, this even came up at the state level. There was talks about adding chickens to the law against livestock trespassing, because you don't want trespassing chickens.
Right. So fence them in appropriately, I guess. That's not a good look if you're the politician who takes away a four-year-old girl's pet
and somebody's
chickens.
Eggs, fresh eggs.
That's not great. Well, anyway, I want to thank you all for being on the program today. And Anna Brown, Director in Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, Kevin Landrigan, Union Leader State House Reporter, and Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Thank you all very much for being on the program today.
Have a great weekend.
Such a pleasure.
Hey, thanks, Peter.
Thanks also to WMUR, who provided some audio from Andrew Valinsky earlier in the program. Remember, listeners, if you are looking for a story that we discussed today, including that story about the chickens, check it out at nhpr.org. We've got links to all of them there. The conversation continues at nhpr.org or on our Facebook page. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brinley is our program manager. Rebecca Lavoie working the cameras today. And our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.